intentions, but when the ads go, I think about it now. In my infliction, entrepreneurial conditions take us to glory. I think about it now.
Get our conversations, call the United Nations, to feed that vocation, celebrate the ancients, come on, all creation, call it celebration, for United Nations, put it to your head.
Oh, great white city.
Hello and welcome to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway for Sunday, March 17th, 2024. My name is James Marino, and in the broadcast today we have Peter Felicia and Michael Portantier. Peter is a playwright, journalist, and historian with a number of books. His new book, Brain Teasers for Broadway Geniuses, is now available wherever finer books are sold. Peter also has columns at Masterworks, Broadway, Broadway Select, and many other places. Hello, Peter.
Good morning.
Hello. Also with us is Michael Portantier. Michael's a theater reviewer and essayist. He's the founder and editor of castalbumreviews.com. He is also a theatrical photographer whose photos have appeared in the New York Times and other major publications. You could see his photography work at followspotphoto.com. Hello, Michael.
Hello.
Is everybody enjoying this beautiful beginning of spring weather before the allergies are launched?
You bet.
No, I think that's already happened.
Yeah, it's but it is beautiful. And Michael, you are going to make your way over to Wagner College today to do what?
To see Me and My Girl.
Oh, nice.
A delightful spring show.
Yeah. One of my all-time favorites. You know why? Because almost everybody in it is nice and trying to do the right thing.
Yes.
That's what I love about it.
I'm sure that's the reason why it was so successful. Mm-hmm. A reason why.
Peter, you have gone super viral here in the last 2 weeks on social media with your lists. And where does Me and My Girl fall on your list? Do you even know within the 17,000 entries plus?
You know, by the end of this, in a few minutes, I will tell you specifically because I'll pull out that book. What James is referring to is that some people doubted that I had seen 12,700 shows. And so I posted the first page of my Broadway listing, because I have been keeping a record ever since I started going. And it's now two volumes, because the first volume is all New York and the second volume is everywhere else. So Me and My Girl, September 30th, 1986 at the Marquee Theater. So that's where that's when I saw it for the first time. And Robert Lindsay gave one of the greatest performances I've ever seen. And Michael, look for this today. See if you agree with me on this. And that is the fact that Bill Snibson, when he comes into the castle, he's an illegitimate heir. And he is so – Robert Lindsay played it so meek and mild coming into this room where all these highfalutin royals were. And he's so meek and mild, and he just doesn't know what to do, how to handle it. And you feel bad for him, because all of us have gone into a room where we have feared the people that we are going to see in one way or another. Mm. And everybody else I've ever seen do it comes in like a ball of fire going – you know, and doesn't realize that he's being very low class and they're thinking less of him. So you pity him when Robert Lindsay did it. And when everybody else does it, you even want him taken down a peg. So so it's a very important thing to be meek and mild. And you'll tell us next week if indeed whoever played it went for the and an awareness of the fact that he's low class compared to these people. So look for that.
I will notice that moment. I also think it's neat that I'm seeing Me and My Girl, and Marianne Plunkett is back on Broadway in a show that Peter's going to tell us about very shortly.
Because
she was wonderful in the original cast.
Yeah.
So, Peter, I just marvel
at your handwriting. It's Boy, so, so people, really wonderful.
So many people like a have font. Commented on that. Yeah, so many people have commented on that. But, you know, 12 years of Catholic school.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. At least in those days. I mean, that was
as,
an important value.
As we will discuss in the review of another show that we're going to
yeah.
talk about.
I wish that there were a Felicia font that I could type all my letters in that handwriting, you know? I think somebody out there, some sort of typographer, should create a Felicia font.
This is all on Facebook, in case people are wondering what we're talking about.
Yeah,
so,
I'll put a link to it in the show notes.
Okay, God love
okay.
you.
Cheryl Hodges-Selden says the nuns used to weep over her handwriting.
Oh. You know?
My mom went to Catholic school, she was left-handed.
Oh,
they didn't allow that.
No, because the Latin word for left is sinister.
Right.
You know, so, it was pretty much discouraged.
And so they forced her to do everything with her right hand, and she was ambidextrous. She could write with either hand, but her handwriting was gorgeous, just like yours.
Isn't that something?
It's really something that's been lost in the digital age.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, what do they say? How to stump a millennial is to put him in a car with a stick shift and cursive instructions. You know,
I suppose that's true. How funny.
So last week we talked about the Professional Performing Arts School, the PPAS, where Michael had seen Titanic. And I saw online this week that the students in the PPAS were doing a fundraiser because of funding cuts and that some of their programs were in jeopardy. So I will, you know, if you're interested in this, I'm going to put a link to their fundraiser in the show notes as well. And Michael, you had a clarification about last week's comments about Titanic.
Oh, yeah. But before that, just briefly on what you're discussing right now, there was a big article in the New York Post. That's where I saw it. And the title is Elite NYC School with Superstar Alums Cuts Theater Program as Vendor and City Point Fingers. Wow. And it says the curtain is coming down on a much lauded theater program at a prestigious performing arts school in Manhattan, which counts A-listers Claire Danes, Jesse Eisenberg, Jeremy Allen White, Alicia Keys, and Britney Spears among its alums. And it is the Professional Performing Arts School in Hell's Kitchen on 48th Street. As you read further into the article, it's a little more complicated. They're not cutting all theater, but they're cutting certain programs within the school, one of which is apparently run partly by Waterwell, the performing arts group Waterwell. Mm. So it's not, it's a little more complicated and less black and white than the Post headline might make it out, but it's still... It's still, of course, it's worrisome. And so we'll see what happens with that, and hope the fundraiser goes well. But it's terrible that they have to resort to something like that.
Sure.
And yeah, my clarification was just actually I owe an apology to Peter Stone because I was talking about the Professional Performing Arts School's production of Titanic, which I had recently seen, along with the NYU Steinhardt production of Titanic, which I saw a few weeks ago, and the video of the somewhat recent London English production of Titanic that I had also seen. I went on and on about how I could not understand why Peter Stoker had decided to kill off the character of the Stoker, Frederick Barrett, originally played on Broadway in the musical by Brian D'Arcy James, when historically he survived the Titanic as a rower of one of the lifeboats. So I just could not figure out why he would do that. Well, are you ready for this?
Yeah.
Talk about stranger than fiction. This is Wikipedia, but I don't think they would make such a point of this if it was not true. Barrett is not to be confused with a fellow crew member, a stoker also named Frederick William Barrett, who perished in the sinking.
Wow.
So it appears there were two Frederick William Barretts as stokers on the Titanic, and one of them died and one of them lived. So I guess we can say that Peter Stone was writing about the unfortunate one.
You know, I thought that the whole trauma of the incident caused him to drink heavily and end up in the next show. So, in a couple of years, nobody will understand that reference. Sort of tangential in the news. I haven't seen this around on the Broadway websites or anything like that, but Sleep No More is having an argument with their landlord.
Yeah,
you heard about that. And so these things happen. Sleep No More has been extending. And sure. So they extended again from February to end of April or something like that. And the landlord was like, said no. And they didn't get the proper licensing permits from the city of New York. So they're having this argument between the landlord and the production. And evidently, anecdotally, people are saying that that performances are canceled, but they're not telling anybody till they get to the building. Oof. I can't say the theater. So again, as Michael was talking about, you know, no respect for the patrons.
That's terrible.
So so if you are going to Sleep No More, you know, kind of, you know, check it out on the socials and see if it's actually happening or not. Heard anything. Yeah.
This brings up something that happened to me on Friday night. I was going to the Marjorie Dean Theater to see Henry V. And as I'm approaching the theater, a guy sees me and starts waving and says, it's canceled. I said, it's canceled. He said, yeah, we sent out emails. You should have gotten emails. And I checked my iPhone, no emails. And I'm thinking, gee, the press agent should have told me about this. I'm very surprised. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I came home and I wrote the press agent. I said, look, I went, but it was canceled. And he wrote back and said, it wasn't canceled. We did the show.
Gee,
the guy told me it was canceled. I mean, so he did a lot of detective work, and he found out that I was approaching the side door of the School of Ethical Culture place, and they were doing something that was canceled. And when he saw me approaching, he just assumed I was going there. So the theater was a little farther up the street. I mean, I it's a theater I rarely go to, so I mean, I just assumed I was in the right place. So as a result, I missed the show.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah, what a funny thing. Yeah,
that's you know, how do you enter that into the log of shows? Rescheduled
an empty space. Yeah,
with a really big asterisk.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Also, I want to let listeners know that Jenna Tessa Fox is back with a new episode of Spotlight, where she talks with Jessica Mulaski, just as the connector wraps up. So that'll be coming to you in the feeds for the Patreon listeners this week and for the general public next week. So first up in our reviews, Peter got a chance to see The Notebook, which is based on the movie. Peter, did you see the movie?
I did. Yeah, I did watch the movie before.
So tell us what you think.
Well, what really impressed me was the fact that Becca Brunstetter, who's a very talented playwright, did The Cake. And I also saw one of her plays in New Jersey a long time ago when she was just starting out. That this is not simply the screenplay on the stage. She has mostly eliminated the dialogue that was in the movie and created her own. The situations are pretty much the same, but nevertheless, she didn't just take the easy way out and say, okay, we'll cut this line and we'll put a song here. So I was very, very impressed by that. I thought it was really terrific that she did that. For those who know The Notebook, and many might because it was a bestseller back in 1996, and that film version in 2004 was very well regarded too. So I think a lot of people know The Notebook. And if you don't, skip over the next few things I'm saying, because as much as I praise Becca Brunstetter for doing her own dialogue, there were some nagging things from the movie that just make no sense to me, and I wish that she had eliminated those. Most specifically, this is about, it's a well told story, God knows, about a highborn woman and a lowerborn guy, and they're in love, and they're young and in love, and her parents are aghast because they regard him as poor white trash, and so they. It's a summer romance, so they leave the summer residence early to get her away from him. So he starts writing her, and he writes her each and every day for a year. For 1 year. It's a little hard to believe that he would be that intent on getting letters to her for a year with no answers whatsoever. I would think he would give up long before a year, but that's up for debate. All right. What happens? Why isn't she answering? Well, because the mother goes to the mailbox every day, sees the letter, and won't give it to her. I would think that it wouldn't take long before Allie, her name is, would suspect, would smell a rat and would go to the mailbox earlier and make sure that that her mother wasn't fooling around. But what's totally unbelievable to me, which is in the book, which is in the movie, which is in the musical, is that the mother keeps the letters. Every one of them. And I would think that those letters would be in the fireplace before the mailman reached the street. I cannot believe she would keep the letters. And it, as the show goes on, she will give Allie the letters many years later. And I mean, that to me is just absurd. And I'm surprised that she left that in, because I would think that, well, anyway, maybe other people can believe it, but I can't. Anyway, there's also a problem with the set. And I know times are tough and all that. It's a unit set, and I don't like when musicals run unit sets. Sometimes it isn't so bad. The Best Little Whorehouse, it was a unit set, and it played fine. And, of course, Tommy Tune was there, so that helped immeasurably as well. But the thing is, one of the things that happened in the movie is that our hero, Noah, buys a glorified shack. I mean, the house is in thorough disrepair. And with the nervous energy of not hearing from Allie at all, he transforms it into a real show place. Well, on a unit set, when she comes and says, "Oh my God, what a beautiful house," all you're seeing is three windows with shutters, a couple of landings, a door, and that's about it. So that moment is really lost. Now, you might say, well, you know, again, raising money for a musical is not easy, and look how many producers are over the title, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, but here's the thing. Anastasia taught us a long time ago that projections can be glorious, and you don't miss scenery when projections are that glorious. And the thing is, I checked my watch, an hour 40 into the 2-hour and 20-minute show. There was a glorious projection in back of a moonlit lake and forest, that type of thing. Well, why not use the projections to show us the house? I think that's a big mistake, because to see that house in the movie go from something that looks like it should be condemned to something you would find in Architectural Digest is something that really needs to be shown. I'm going to be controversial here and say that the show has a lot of non-traditional casting. And so sometimes you will see a white Allie, and sometimes you won't. And sometimes you'll see a white Noah, and sometimes you won't. And the thing is, Becca Brunstetter has added a couple. In the movie, you only see them young and well, a few years older. Here, what she's done is young and very old in the movie and in the book, young and very old, but she's added a middle couple, and and it's not necessary. It really takes you out of the show because it becomes more artificial. You can't bond with people when you see three generations in that way. I mean, you can bond with a young and an old. You can understand that, but it just muddied up things terribly. So I didn't respond to that idea at all. The music, quite right for the era. And by the way, for those who know the original property, which is set in the 40s, she's updated to the 70s and beyond, because she uses the Vietnam War as opposed to the World War II. So Ingrid Michaelson's music sounds right for the era, you know, and her lyrics occasionally do sparkle. at the beginning of the show, we have older Noah, who visits his wife in a nursing home, and she's a victim of Alzheimer's, and he reads from the notebook that their story, that's what he tries to do to jog her memory. And every now and then, just as in The Ferryman, she comes around and her memory is jogged, but only for a few minutes at a time, it seems to be. But anyway, as he's getting up, one of the first lyrics in the show is when he's getting up out of a chair, he says, "Time to let the bones crack into place." So that's a very colorful image. And there are plenty of colorful images in the lyrics. You know, I'm going to mention the fact that the lyrics don't always accurately rhyme. Breathe and leave and time and mine and many others. But the music is right for the era. Very good performances from everybody all around. And, of course, Michael mentioned Marianne Plunkett, who really comes across extraordinarily well. It's very moving at the beginning of the show, where you can tell right away that she's discombobulated and she's having trouble with her memory as people are swirling all around her and she's trying to place who they are desperately. And you, for a long time, you think it's going to be a show where she's not going to sing at all. She finally does sing towards the end of the show, but it's really a masterful performance, especially at one point when she goes to the piano. She's an old woman now. She goes to the piano to play, and it's established that she learned to play when she was a kid, and she goes to the piano and she only plays for a couple of seconds. And I'm telling you, watch the way that she puts the cover over the keys. You really can tell that she is essentially saying, "I've played this piano for the last time. I will never be revisiting this again." So it's a very, very effective moment. Everybody's quite good in it. Everybody sings very well in it, too. I will say that I did feel that the middle couple, that their performances weren't as strong as the other two. But nevertheless, they certainly did the job. Ironically enough, the middle couple, what we have is Ryan Vasquez, and he seems a little dorkier than John Cardoza, who's playing the younger one, which is kind of strange. And not only that, but Joy Woods, who plays Middle Allie, seems more callow, strangely enough, than Jordan Tyson, who plays her younger. So I had a bit of a problem with that. And again, I'm not responding to the middle couple at all anyway. As I say, I wish they had been eliminated. But whatever you want to say about Joy Woods, she certainly sings her 11 o'clock number with great gusto. Everybody sings very well. The voices are excellent. So it's a mixed bag. I worry about tourists coming to New York and being confused by the non-traditional casting because they're not used to it. Broadway is a tourist industry, and they don't get it anywhere else. Hollywood doesn't use non-traditional casting either in movies or TV. I'm not saying that you don't see minorities in certain roles. What I am saying is I don't believe that movies and TV shows have black and white siblings representing white siblings, that type of thing. And considering the fact that the Broadway League said a long time ago that I think this is about a 20-year ago survey that a heavy theater goes to Broadway four times a year. And considering the prices have skyrocketed since that study, I bet it's three or two, or maybe even one or none. But anyway, people who come, I think, are going to be confused. Even if they don't notebook very well, I think they'll be confused. So I'm all for non-traditional casting, but I do think it's a problem when it comes to families, because I think a lot of theater goers must be either confused or put off by it. But anyway, a mixed bag here. I wish it well. And, you know, a few years ago when Bridges of Madison County happened, I really thought that was going to be a smash hit because the book was so popular and the movie was so popular, and it didn't happen. We'll see if The Notebook, again, a bestseller, A very successful movie, a much regarded, well regarded movie. We'll see if this one can work out in a very crowded end of the 2023-24 season.
I haven't seen the show yet, but two comments. A friend of mine who saw it right after they started performances said almost exactly what you said about the three couples, in particular, what you said specifically about how it was not necessary to have three. There should have been two. And partly because the span, apparently the time span between the youngest couple and the somewhat older couple is, I think they said only about 8 years.
Something. Yeah. It's almost like negligible. It really is. Yeah.
Yeah. So who knows why they did that? I mean, they could have saved two salaries, and he also used the same expression you did about that. You need to bond with these characters, and it's hard to bond with them when there's three different versions of them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as for the other thing, and not to get into it, but it's not just, of course, it's not just a race thing. And it's not that they're playing people in the same family. It's they're playing the same characters. But if you had, for example, if the middle guy was played by someone who had bright red hair and was short and stout, and then the older one was played by someone who was 6'3" and had very dark hair and was very thin. I mean, I think that would be equally confusing as to them being the same character.
Sure.
So we should just remember that it's really not just a race thing. It's just seeing things represented to clue you into the fact that it's the same character.
Michael, when do you go see it?
I have this week, Thursday, I believe.
Oh, I'll be there Thursday. Yeah. So I'll see you there. Okay. Probably be sitting next to each other.
Good.
All right. So we'll report back again next week after Michael and I see The Notebook. It's playing at the Schoenfeld. It's an open-ended run right now. And we'll have a link to that in the show notes. Michael and Peter got over to the Todd Haymes Theater to see a production of Doubt. So, Michael, why don't you get us started on this?
Well, I had a very John Patrick Shanley week because I saw Doubt, and the night before I saw Brooklyn Laundry, his new play, which Peter talked about last week, and I'll just talk about briefly later. But Doubt is certainly one of the highlights of John Patrick Shanley's career, which has been very erratic, to say the least. When he's good, he's incredibly good, and when not, not so much. And there have been a lot of misfires along the way, but Doubt, I think, has proven itself as a very, very, very solid play about a set in the 60s about a nun who is a principal of a school in St. Nicholas Catholic Church and School in the Bronx, 1964, we're in specifically, and she gets it in her head that Father Flynn is having improper relations with at least one boy in the school. And despite any real proof to that effect, she is determined to call him on the carpet for this and hopefully get rid of him. A foil for her is the character of Sister James, who really defends Father Flynn and says that she doesn't believe the story. And then the fourth character in the play is Mrs. Muller, who is the mother of a black child. We are told the only black student in the entire school. Again, this is the Bronx, 1964. And she comes to the school because she is requested to by Sister Aloysius because Donald Muller, Mrs. Muller's son, is the one whom Sister Aloysius suspects is being molested by Father Flynn. Excuse me. Father Flynn was one of the priests that I had. excuse me, Father Flynn. But I'm sure there was a Father Flynn too. So it's about Doubt is the title, and that is what the play is about. There were sermons about it that that Father Flynn delivers during the show, which are very, very compelling, in a compelling performance by Liev Schreiber. Tyne Daly, as I'm sure all of our listeners know, was to have played Sister Aloysius, but unfortunately had some kind of medical incident right before the show and dropped out totally, completely, permanently. And Amy Ryan was rushed in to the role, and I thought she did a wonderful job, although, again, I will mention that I had heard that Isabel Keating, who is the understudy, had also done a great job in the interim, and I'm not sure why they didn't just keep her. Sister James is Zoe Kazan, and Mrs. Muller is Quincy Tyler Bernstein. The most interesting thing here to me is that if people who saw the movie of Doubt will certainly remember that that role was played by Viola Davis, and she chose to play it very, very, I don't want to say weepy because that sounds weak, extremely upset with a lot of crying over the situation, especially when Sister Aloysius threatens that her son may have to leave the school. All this mother wants is for him to graduate, and because of the opportunities that will give him if he graduates from this school. And she also mentioned that he had been terribly bullied when he was in public school. So that's all she wants, and it seems threatened. And so it's completely valid to play the role as the woman is completely distraught and crying and very, 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 very upset. Quincy Tyler Bernstein did not make that choice. She certainly seemed concerned and upset, but she maintained control throughout the scene. And I wonder if that was, you know, how much of that was her decision, how much was the director, Scott Ellis. I actually prefer the other interpretation, but I thought this worked very fine considering that she had, that she made that choice, and it certainly did make the part her own. Doubt is one of those plays that really gets the audience to debating. As I was leaving, a woman seated in front of me was very loudly saying to all of the people around her, "Well, obviously he's guilty. Where's the doubt?" And one of the men that she was with said, "Why do you say that? I don't agree." And indeed, the very last line of the play, after Sister Aloysius, for an hour and a half, being absolutely, completely, totally convinced, you know, to the point where she does get Father Flynn out of the school, although he goes to another school. But after being 1,000% certain that he's guilty, her very last line is that she starts to weep and she says, "Oh, Sister James, I have doubt." So I don't know why that woman was so convinced when Sister Aloysius herself was not. But I think it's great. Of course, any play that can cause that kind of debate within an audience, I think it's really doing its job. And it was wonderful to see Doubt again, because it's a great play of its type, I think.
Okay. So, Peter, what did you think?
Well, you know, again, as somebody who was a veteran of 12 years of Catholic education, had nuns every step of the way, not one lay teacher at all, I have to say that my interpretation of this play is that some of these women really are kind of crazy because they don't have much interaction with the world. And the fact that, as Michael said, that she's 1,000% sure, and no, I won't even say 999% sure. I mean, 1,000% sure. And then suddenly at the end, she's feeling doubt. I mean, yeah, it really indicates to me that these ladies have a lot to learn about life. Shanley does an excellent job of keeping us guessing, because really, why does Father Flynn resign? Why doesn't he fight her? I mean, is truth on his side or is it not? So I think that's very, very skillful. I tell you, seeing Cherry Jones originally in this, there's a very dynamic moment in the play that was beautifully done by Cherry Jones and by Meryl Streep in the movie, but not by Amy Ryan here. But this is not necessarily a castigation of Amy Ryan. Let me explain. Before Sister Aloysius accuses Father Flynn of anything, she gets him to come to her office and ostensibly to talk about the Christmas pageant that's happening. But that's not the real reason. She really wants to confront him with this information. And finally, he says to her, well, do you want to talk about the Christmas pageant? Do you want to talk about this? And I'm telling you, Cherry Jones immediately said this. And Meryl Streep immediately said this. And Amy Ryan pauses and then says this. And it is so effective to see her, the sister, do it immediately. As if, you know, we're coming down to brass tacks. There's no wiggle room on this whatsoever. However, I think a case can be made that Amy Ryan is doing the right thing, too, because after all, if she's a person who's going to eventually have doubt, that's a place where she can show it. So I think there's validity in both approaches, but it is very effective to have this nun say this right away. I thought Amy Ryan was fine. I thought Philippe Schreiber was fine. I thought everybody was fine. I do think it's a very good production, but I'm still mystified at the end when she says she has doubt and bursts into tears. By the way, about Viola Davis, watching the movie again, you know, I'm always so impressed. I know it's not that big a deal. Actors will tell you it's not that big a deal. But to me, it seems like a big deal when somebody can cry. And I know that you, what you're supposed to is conjure up the worst memory you've ever had in your life. And that will spur you into crying. I know that that's the procedure. But Viola Davis doesn't just cry. She gets her nose to run, too. Now, I don't know if it's glycerin all over the place or what have you, but it's so impressive that she not only cries when she has to, but she gets her nose running too. Watch the movie and you'll see that. And as Michael points out, it's a very different interpretation here. And so you, even if you're in the front row, you ain't going to see tears or a runny nose. But very commendable revival, and also a pretty nice set design, I have to say. You'd think it's going to be very, very spare as it starts. But David Rockwell has a few tricks up his sleeve, and it really turns out to be far more ornate than you will think it's going to be when you walk in and you see the curtain up.
Okay. So that is Doubt at the Todd Hames. It's playing through April 21st. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. Check it out there. Michael, as you mentioned previously, you got to see Brooklyn Laundry at Manhattan Theater Club at City Center. Peter talked about it last week. What were your takes on this?
Yeah, well, as I indicated, I would not rate this as highly as Doubt. To put it mildly, I think this is one of the bigger misfires of Shanley's career. And I was so disappointed because the first scene I thought was an absolutely, utterly delightful setup for a really wonderful and funny and sweet romantic comedy. I won't go on at length because Peter talked about the show last week, but it's set in a laundry in Brooklyn, as you might think. That scene is anyway. And there is the fellow who owns the laundry as well as two others. And his name is Owen, played by David Zayas, one of our best actors. A customer comes in, Fran, played by Cecily Strong. And we come to understand that she's a regular customer, but she doesn't usually deal with Owen because he's usually not there. There was a woman who had been running that location, and he says that she won the lottery, so she quit. And Fran asks, oh, how much did she win? And he said, $200. He said, I think reality is going to set in and she'll call me tomorrow. so that was the kind of just really great characters, really funny. One of those situations where there's sort of conflict and sarcasm between the two characters, but you can also see that there's a huge attraction between them. And I just thought that it was completely delightful. And it reminded me of the kind of writing that Shanley did in Moonstruck. Just absolutely terrific. But then I just thought each successive scene became more and more incredible, and things just fell apart. What happens to poor Fran is like more than, you know, worse than what happens to Job in the Bible, almost. And I completely agree. Again, we can't give away too much here without any spoilers, but something that happens at the very end seemed to me beyond credibility. Nothing that would ever conceivably happen in real life, especially because within that same final scene, what had happened earlier in that scene, things were stated outright and categorically that were to the opposite of what the final decision was. If those two scenes had been broken up and we were told that there were a few weeks or a few months between those two scenes, then the final decision that Owen makes in regard to Fran might have been credible. But I just thought it, as it was, it seemed completely schematic and just a playwright saying, oh, what's going to be like really, you know, unexpected and interesting for an audience here, even though it didn't make any sense whatsoever. I wish that Shanley would try to write an out and out comedy or romantic comedy for the stage, or, you know, or for film again. But for the stage, I think that would be great. I'm trying to think, he had several flop shows, to be blunt, that I saw, and I have almost no memory of them. So I can't remember if any of those would have been, I think there was one that was sort of like a romantic comedy. Do you recall, Peter?
Is Danny in the Deep Blue Sea?
Oh, you know, actually, I have never seen that. And that is another one that's considered one of his best. Could not get into the recent Off-Broadway revival. That's to my point. I mean, there again, there's a certain style that he seems to do well in, and I just wish he would do more of it as a playwright.
So you invoked Moonstruck, and it immediately took me down a rabbit hole thinking about, wasn't Moonstruck supposed to become a Broadway play or a Broadway musical?
A musical.
Henry Krieger was going to write it back in 2000, 2001, 2002. And now it's being talked about the Metropolitan Opera, Ricky Ian Gordon and Patrick Shanley in an article in the New York Times last year. So I don't know, Michael. Oh, what do you think?
I think I missed that.
Well, I will put it in the show notes just for you, Michael.
Oh my gosh.
New York Times article about 11 months ago, April of 2023, talks about the Metropolitan Opera developing Moonstruck with Ricky Ian Gordon and John Patrick Shanley.
I think when Henry Krieger was working on it, was that when Idina Menzel was supposed to star?
That would be interesting. Yeah.
But then more recently, there has been talk of another attempt at a musical with another team. And nothing has come of that yet either. So maybe that's been abandoned. I mean, obviously they're not going to let them. An opera and a musical.
I sort of feel like it would work better as a musical than an opera, So I don't know. You know, I mean, I'm a fan of Ricky Ian Gordon, but sometimes I just don't feel like I can connect to some of the work that he does and make some of the decisions he makes.
And the Met is far too big a place for that kind of a comedy. It would have to be a completely
broad comedy, you know, broad well, comedy.
Yeah, maybe.
All right. So that is a recap of Brooklyn Laundry at Manhattan Theater Club at the City Center. It is playing through April 14th. So you have about a month to go check it out. I'll have a link to that in the show notes, as well as the article from the New York Times that I just talked about, and also WNYC, which is a local NPR station in New York, had an interview with Cecily Strong, David Zayas, and playwright John Patrick Shanley, and it's a good listen. So if you're a fan of those three, I'll put that in the show notes for you to take a listen to there. So, Peter, you were in New Jersey to see two Sondheim shows, the first being Sunday in the Park with George. Did you see it at the Axelrod Performing Arts Center?
Yeah, in Deal, New Jersey. And it did turn out to be a big deal because what happened was Eamon Foley, a name that you may know from the musical 13, but more to the point, I remember him so vividly when he was an 11-year-old child in a musical called The Audience, where it was watching an audience watching a musical. And he is this little boy going to the theater for the first time and just as enthralled as so many of us were when we went to the theater for the first time. And he had a wonderful song called I Like What I See. Well, I certainly did like what I saw at the Axelrod Performing Arts Center. In a terrific production of Sunday in the Park with George, which was not business as usual, believe me. It was very much reconceived and all to the good. I'm nothing against the original production, of course, but what was really impressive was the fact that we're dealing with a pointillist painting, so we had dancers representing the different colors that show up in the painting. Now, granted, it is stated late in the show that that George used 11 different colors and not black. Eamon Foley, with a budgetary constriction, I'm sure, had six. But watching these ballet performers, you know, often on point, coming around the stage and representing the colors was very effective. I thought it was a great idea, so I liked it very, very much. And in terms of the chroma loom, he had a very different feeling about that too. There was no big heavy device in the center of the stage. He simply used theater lights on stage, about two or three dozen of them. And there was a light show that came from all these different lights, and it was very effective. So it was, I think, a very good way of saving on the budget too, to do it that way. Well, of course, any production of Sunday in the Park is going to rise or fall on the George and the Dot / Marie, because of course Dot is in the first act and Marie, her child, is in the second act. So Graham Phillips was terrific and in terrific voice as George, just wonderful, a secure performance, really delineating between the George from the previous century and the one from the previous century, now that you think of it, because it is established that it's 1984. This is a show that will always have to have its second act in 1984, because how could Marie live, you know, 40 more years? And Talia Suskower, phenomenal to start. Beautiful voice, lots of characterization. She has lots of opportunities to do it too. And it was not by any stretch a Bernadette Peters imitation. She really made it her own in both scenes. So everybody else was terrific as well. I really admired so many of them. I really was impressed to see that Eamon Foley has become quite the director and choreographer on the basis of what he showed here. So it was a very good trip to Deal, New Jersey, and I'm delighted I made it. I'm also delighted I went to A Little Night Music in Rahway, New Jersey, at American Theater Group. And here we have another performer who's directing the show, and it's Hunter Foster. And I think he did a very good job. And again, budget may have determined this, but there were no leader singers per se. What happened was the cast came out and sang much, not all, but much of that overture. And, you know, I've always felt that Sunday in the Park, I'm sorry, Little Night Music made a big mistake by having these people come out in the original production and start singing, because the audience must have assumed these were the people that were going to follow all night. These were the main characters. I wish that there had been and projection, not that there were so many projections back in 1973. But in subsequent productions, I've always wished that they would project on the back wall overture so that people would be clear that this, because you don't think of an overture with people singing. Yeah, I mean, Nine has one, but I mean, really, very few overtures are sung. There's an occasional song sung in an overture in Irene and Bravo Giovanni and a few others too, but A Clear Day. But never, hardly ever, maybe seldom ever, is an overture sung. So it's confusing. But having the whole cast come out and sing these snippets of songs makes a difference. It's less confusing. So I thought that was really good. Who do we have in this cast? We have Kate Baldwin playing Desiree, and we have Graham Rowat playing Frederick. Now, the chemistry between them is good, and it should be, because they're a real married couple. So it was so moving at the end when they get together at the end and sing the reprise of Send in the Clowns. You know, to look at the love in their eyes, I had a very good seat, and to see the love really pouring through was just wonderful, and you know that it's real, so that's terrific. Ruth Gottschall. Ruth Gottschall has been around a long, long time, was in the revival of Best Little Whorehouse back in 1982, has never really had a chance to on Broadway to have an amazing role. So, and God knows Madame Armfelt is an amazing role. I will say that she seems a little too young, let her youth be her consolation, to die at the end of the show. And I wouldn't be surprised if people didn't understand that she died at the end of the show, because what Hunter Foster decided to do was have her get up from the chair and be in the final waltz. And but it was very quick, the way she closed her eyes. But I don't think anybody would really feel that she was near death, the way you felt about Hermione Gingold and so many others, about Sheila Smith, who recently did die. Phenomenal in a White Plains production a few years ago. Really terrific. Cast solid, but of course, who's always going to steal the show is going to be the actress who plays Charlotte, the wife of Count Magnus, who really is a long, you hear the term long suffering employed quite often. It really applies here, because she's very much aware that her husband is fooling around with Desiree, and she just doesn't know what to do about it. And of course, women had so fewer options in the turn of the previous century. So that's part of it. But she, despite everything, loves him, as she confesses after she says she hates him. And Lord knows there's a fine line between love and hate, as the apple tree mentions. But anyway, so Abby Middleton did a fine job, and certainly was wonderfully acerbic without being off-putting, which is what you have to be. And that's why Patricia Elliott got a Tony for it, and a well-deserved one, too. So great, great fun. And it was so nice to see an audience respond to it so well. They really, truly, truly, truly enjoyed every delicious line. They didn't miss anything. You know, there was a production in Boston a few years ago at the Huntington, which missed one of the great jokes of all time. And it was amazing to me, because in the script, the word is italicized. And they should know this, you know, from the italics. But anyway, the point is that Frederick has married a young girl, and too young. And one of the themes of the show really is, you know, that young people belong with young people and older people belong with older people. They have much more in common with each other. I really do believe that that is a theme of the show. I've never seen anybody say that or read that, but nevertheless, I truly believe that. But anyway, so Frederick has married this very young girl, and he comes to the manse of the Armfelts, and he introduces his wife to Desiree. And Desiree, of course, wants him. And she brings her daughter and says, "And this is my daughter," implying that he's married somebody who's young enough to be his daughter. And I'm telling you, in Boston a few years ago, the actress simply said, "And this is my daughter." And it's italicized. I mean, didn't the director notice? I mean, it's very bizarre to me. Or maybe he just didn't want it. I can't believe that the actress wouldn't know enough to do it, considering this italicized. Anyway, a terrific production, has a week to go. And I really do believe that if you get out to Rahway, which is not hard to get to, you get on a Penn Station, Newark, Elizabeth, Linden Rahway, four stops, unless you take one that stops at Secaucus, I'll grant you. But anyway, it's not far. Lots of good restaurants on the way to the theater. So make a night of it, and you'll have a very, 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 very good time.
Okay. So Hunter is really... He's got a lot of stuff going on.
Yeah, really.
Well, he directed that incredibly wonderful production of the Bridges of Madison County that I saw at the Axelrod. When was that? Two years ago or more?
Maybe.
And which also had Kate Baldwin in it. So these people are really doing a lot of great stuff in New Jersey.
Okay. So I will have a link to American Theater Group's website, as well as how to get tickets. It's running through March 24th, so you have just about a week to get through there to check it out. And all that information's in the show notes. Okay, so that wraps it up for today. Before we get on to our brain teasers and our musical moments, I want to remind everybody that you can subscribe to these broadcasts by going to the front page of BroadwayRadio.com. This is a subscribe link. That way, each and every time we have a new episode of This Week on Broadway, it'll be automatically downloaded to Apple Podcasts for you. Of course, you don't have to listen to us on Apple Podcasts. There's many ways to get us. Patreon, patreon.com/BroadwayRadio is one way that you can get our podcasts earlier than everybody else, especially that upcoming Jenna Tessa Fox interview with Jessica Mulaski. So patreon.com/BroadwayRadio, you can support all of Broadway Radio's shows as well as get our podcast early. And it's Matt and Grace are actually doing tons of extra content as well. So you can get extra stuff there as well, not available anywhere else. Spotify, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, Pandora, Google Play, YouTube Music are all different places. Anywhere that you can listen to your finer podcast, you're going to find Broadway Radio's offerings. Contact information for Peter, for Michael, and for me can be found in the show notes at BroadwayRadio.com, as well as links to some of the things we've talked about today. So, Peter, do you have an answer to last week's musical moment?
I asked.
You don't have an answer to musical moment.
Well, in a sense, I do, because certainly one had to listen to cast albums to determine the answer. I asked readers, listeners, to first play A Fact Can Be a Beautiful Thing on the 1968 original Broadway cast album of Promises, Promises, right to the end. Then I asked them to play the first minute of the overture of the 1963 musical Here's Love. And that after they experienced both, the name of a certain musical might come to mind. And I gave a hint that it was produced in a season that also saw one of those two musicals that I had named above. Well, at the end of A Fact Can Be a Beautiful Thing, you'll hear a fade out. At the beginning of Here's Love, you'll hear a fade in to the Majesty's Thanksgiving Day Parade. And in the same season that Here's Love was produced, so was the Carol Burnett vehicle, fade out, fade in. Sean Logan was the first to get it, followed by Nikki Juven, Tony Janicki, J. Aubrey Jones, Josh Israel, Brigadude, Ingrid Gammerman, and Fred Abramowitz. This week's question, two 20th century Tony-winning musicals opened 20 years apart to the day. Both had one person in common. He certainly wasn't the most important individual in the first one, but he was arguably the most important one in the second one. Who is he? What are the musicals?
Hey, if you have an answer for that, email us at trivia@BroadwayRadio.com. Let you know if you're on the right track. So, Michael, we had news this week that Illinois, I have not seen it at Park Avenue Armory, but it might be coming. It is coming. Definitely coming, says Philip Boroff, to Broadway this season. So tell us how that ties into the musical moments.
Yes, it's not official in the sense that there hasn't been a press release yet, but it was reported, as you mentioned, that it will be opening at the St. James just in time for Tony Award eligibility. And I forget, Peter, you've seen this and reported on it. Is that correct?
Well, I've seen it. Yes, it's a dance show, and dancing is very effective. Two singers provide the background music, and they're both terrific. The music is very nice.
Yes, I think, are they referring to it as a dance musical?
I believe so.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like what it would. And if I understand correctly, the singing doesn't necessarily, well, it has to do with what's happening in the show, but it's not, they're not supposed to be the characters, right?
No, I don't think so. No.
Yeah. And apparently it is actually based on a 2005 album by a singer songwriter named Sufjan Stevens. And interestingly enough, the title of the album seems to be somewhat in dispute, because it says on the album cover, "Come on, feel the Illinois." But the word Illinois is in a larger typeface, and the E at the end of Illinois is set off slightly. So apparently some people consider the title of the album to be Illinois, and some people consider it to be Illinois. So I think that's kind of interesting. But whatever, if from what I understand, not having seen it yet, very much looking forward to it. It's a very freeform dance piece with singing about just inspired by things that either did happen in the state or could happen in the state, all kinds of things. There's a there's a song or at least a musical piece in it that apparently has to do with Mary Todd Lincoln, which is interesting because, of course, we have O Mary playing off Broadway now. And then there's another piece. Well, there are all sorts of very interesting titles here that make me just really, really look forward to seeing the show when it moves to Broadway. So the music, I had not heard of it until this week when I started to research it when I read the news, and I really like it. So I hope you do too. We're featuring two selections today as our musical moments. The opener is the aforementioned "Come On, Feel the Illinois." And the closer is a piece titled "The Man of Metropolis Steals Our Hearts." It sounds like a lot of fun. People are raving about the choreography by Justin Peck. Robbie Fairchild is in it. Mm-hmm. It's just gotten a lot of tremendous response. Will be interesting to see how it does on Broadway. But on the other hand, the fellow who wrote the article, Philip Boroff, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Broadway Journal, Philip Boroff. Mm-hmm.
He ran the numbers and seems to think that it could recoup in 10 weeks.
Wow.
And the St. James is a large theater, so mm-hmm. depending on what the demand is, it could even recoup quicker than that. It doesn't sound like it would necessarily appeal to a traditional Broadway audience, mm-hmm. but if it only needs to run for 10 weeks, then maybe it doesn't have to, you know, have universal appeal. So I am very, very interested to see it. And in the meantime, that entire album, by the way, is available on YouTube. If you have no other way to get it, access to it, you can really enjoy it there.
I don't expect that either one of you will know this. There was in the 80s, a band called Quiet Riot had a song called "Come On, Feel the Noise." Uh-huh. And this is not that. It is very, very different. So it also was, "Come On, Feel the Noise" was also released by the rock band Slade in 73. So these are very, very different things. These are not comparable. So, but you'll hear it for yourself. So on behalf of Michael Portantier and Peter Felicia, this is James Marino saying thanks so much for listening to Broadway Radio's This Week on Broadway. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye.
Golden eyes.